In Puerto Rico, there's adventure around every corner and natural treasures waiting to be explored, like El Yunque, the only tropical rainforest in the U.S. Get swept away by natural beauty and come away with unique stories that could only be experienced in Puerto Rico and that remind you why you travel in the first place. Visits end, but stories last forever. You don't become a part of the island, it becomes a part of you. No passports required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh, and there's Chuck, and Jerry's here too, and this is Stuff You Should Know. A good old history edition, if you ask me, by goodness.
History of the World, part two.
I don't think I saw that since I was maybe eight, and at the time I was like, I have no idea what's going on or why people think this is funny.
Yeah, well, that was part one. Part two is out now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we're not getting paid for this, but I'll plug the heck out of it. It's on Hulu, and they waited, you know, it's like a 40-year-in-the-making sequel that they did as a TV show with Mel Brooks executive producing and narrating. But it's like some of the great minds in comedy out there doing, you know, history sketches.
Is Michael Fassbender in it?
I don't think so. Is he one of the great comedy minds?
I think so.
It's really funny, though, like genuinely laugh out loud funny.
Yeah, I got to check it out because those things are rare and few and far between.
Yeah, it's good stuff. You know, sketch, so not everything is perfect, but it's I found myself laughing quite a bit so far. I've seen three of them, I think.
Okay. It's on Hulu?
It's on Hulu.
And what happens if you don't have Hulu? Do you just go subscribe?
I don't know how you can watch it.
I think you just go subscribe to Hulu is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, sure. But this sounds like an ad for Hulu. I don't know about TV shows. You can just go out and buy a show, right?
Sure. You can buy whatever you want. It's the 21st century.
Right. Should we talk about the Bronze Age?
Yeah, let's go back a few centuries, a few millennia, actually, to the Bronze Age.
Great age.
It was a great age. It was actually the first great age. I think most people are familiar with the term Bronze Age, but they might not know like just how amazing an age it really was. Like just eye-poppingly amazing, frankly, if you think of it.
Yeah, and it was specifically wedged between the Stone Age, which stones worked great for millions of years for a lot of things.
Yeah.
Bronze came along and then was followed by the Iron Age, where we were plunged into the Dark Ages.
Yeah.
But we're talking, what, 3300 BCE to about 1200 BCE.
Mm-hmm. A little over 1,000 years.
Yeah, and it had a lot to do with bronze, which we'll talk about, but also just advances in almost everything you can think of.
Yeah, art, architecture, politics, diplomacy, technology, religion, warfare.
Their version of science.
Yeah, the early sciences, early astronomy and math, writing. All of this stuff was born during this 1,000-year stretch of the Bronze Age. And again, like you might say, well, 1,000 years, of course you could invent all that in 1,000 years. But think about it. We were around for tens of thousands of years as modern humans and millions of years as hominids of some sort or another up to that point. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, boom, civilization just develops out of nowhere. And it was in large part because of bronze itself. Not just that bronze tools are way better than stone tools. They're more easily sharpened. You can fashion them more easily. You can recycle them. So when they get busted up, you can re-smelt them and make it brand new again. That's a huge advance in technology. Sure. But the actual bronze itself, in a really roundabout but also pretty direct way, wove people together in ways that they never had been before that led to civilization.
Yeah. It's really cool how the discovery of metallurgy just changed so much in a very, you know, if you look at the big picture, a very short amount of time.
Yeah. So there were, if you want to make bronze, you take copper and you take a little bit of tin, which is usually the alloy that makes bronze.
You just smash them together with your hands.
You do over the course of 15 years, and then yeah. Bam, you have bronze. You melt them, you smelt them. And he who smelt it dealt it, right?
That's right.
And you have bronze and you can fashion it into tools. But to get copper and tin together, you have to go to all sorts of different places in the Mediterranean. You have plenty of copper, say, on Cyprus. That was a copper mining center. But then if you wanted tin, you had to go a couple thousand miles, few thousand kilometers to the east, if I'm not mistaken. To the east.
Okay.
To Afghanistan, which was a tin center. And to get that tin and that copper together, you had to create really extensive trade networks. You had to go through one land to another. So you had to make friends or make enemies with those people. Yeah. And all of these new relationships developed just to get the components to make bronze together. And that formed the basis of all the stuff that seemed to follow.
Yeah. And we'll talk about the warring. There was certainly that. But there was also a lot of cooperation because everyone wanted to get their hands on that sweet bronze.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, hey, if you want to play with the big fellas,
yeah,
then maybe become part of this trade route. Allow us to go through your area with the tin or whatever, or maybe you have something that we need other than just, you know, being on the way. But there's a lot of cooperation involved, too. As far as the bronze, what that led to ultimately was better, and this is the sort of the cascading effect that a discovery like this can have,
mm-hmm.
Better farming techniques. And you might think, well, great. So you could farm better, but that means you could farm bigger, and that means you could support more people, and that means you could get a civilization going. And because you had, before you previously had a situation where like, hey, listen, everyone's got to hunt and gather, mm-hmm. and then later on, everyone's got to farm because we just can't support ourselves unless everyone's kind of in on this.
Right.
Now they had more sophisticated techniques, so fewer people had to farm to support more people even,
mm-hmm.
and that freed up people who were good at other stuff to do other stuff. So that's the cascading effect that you were sort of alluding to, where like this one thing led to farming, better farming, but that better farming led to division of labor, where it's like, hey, I'm really good at science. Hey, I'm a really good writer. But everyone always said, don't waste your time writing because we need you farming.
Right. It's brand new. It might not stick around. It could just be a fad, this writing thing.
It might just go away.
So, yeah, and with that division of labor, the writers can write, the math people can figure out math, the farmers can farm and feed everybody. And then one of the other big pillars of support for this division of labor that allowed it to blossom was centralized governments that said, farmers, we're in charge of you. Make X amount of grain and bring it to this central place. Everybody else, come to this central place and get your grain. We're taking care of you. We're feeding you so you guys can go off and concentrate on this other stuff and help civilization flourish. So government is a huge, sweeping, bureaucratic, hierarchical entity. Really got established in the Bronze Age as well, just because there were so many people being strung together, again, in the service of creating bronze.
Yeah, and hey, while you're at it, enslaved people, why don't you build huge statues of me and mm-hmm. and big monuments of myself as the leader of you? So that's kind of what happened, you know, the establishment of government from the very beginning sort of gaveth and tooketh away.
Mm-hmm.
Gaveth in that all the things you were saying, which was great about organizing large groups of people, but took it away because every civilization was built on the backs of enslaved people. And if not enslaved, at the very least, they established a real kind of like never before, a real hierarchy of, hi, I'm in charge and you're not, so you don't matter as much.
Yeah, that was definitely new. I mean, you always had things like, you know, shaman or some sort of like probably group leader or elders or something like that.
Right.
For hunter-gatherer bands, but nothing like this where
systemic.
You didn't even come close to talking to or knowing personally the person who was your ultimate leader. Like that was brand new. And what's interesting, Chuck, is you said, you know, kind of for better or for worse about the government emerging. You can really see how you feel about today's world by how you interpret what was born and what happened during the Bronze Age. It's like looking in a highly polished bronze mirror, basically. It's really interesting what reflects back. And it's not always cut and dried. Like, I have certain feelings about, you know, topics like government or whatever, but I also, in looking back a few thousand years, it's also easy to see the other side's opinion because they're not all up in my face. They're several thousand years old, and I can kind of now understand contemporary people's feelings about, say, government or something as well. I think that's just fascinating. That's ultimately why history is so important, because you really do learn lessons from it. You can, like, humans are not, we like to think we're super advanced compared to, you know, the people of a few thousand years ago, but we're still basically the same humans that we were back during the Bronze Age. And so there is a lot to learn.
I agree. You know, we mentioned that there was warring. Obviously, when you're going to get bigger groups of people together and governments ruling those people, and they're in close proximity to one another, you know, neighbored right up to each other, there's going to be people that don't get along, and there is obviously going to be warring. But like we mentioned, there was also a lot of diplomacy, and there was a very sort of golden age of this golden age, kind of square in the middle, where things were cruising along really, really nicely. I think these, sort of looking back at it, it seems like at the beginnings of a big, grand transition like this, things can be rough. And as we'll see at the end, given that it basically collapsed, it's obviously rough. But there was a time in the middle there where things were going pretty great.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's that middle Bronze Age prosperity. And it actually kind of underscores the idea that when you bring a lot of people together, you can do amazing, momentous things. But if you bring a lot of diverse people together, you've got a lot of different attributes, different contributions from different groups.
And opinions.
Yeah, and opinions. And affluence and prosperity can really follow when people of diverse backgrounds interact with one another on large scales.
Amen.
That's pretty cool.
Should we take a break?
Sure.
It's kind of an early break, but it feels like a good stopping point. And maybe when we come back, we'll talk about the Big Eight.
Hey everybody, it's time you heard about Squarespace. Squarespace has the tools you need to create and sell your own website. Whether it's an online course or custom merch, Squarespace has you covered.
That's right. Courses is a great program. You can start with a professional layout that fits your brand, upload video lessons to teach techniques and skills, and tailor your course with a powerful Fluid Engine editor.
That's right. With Fluid Engine, which is a next generation website design system, by the way, it's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity.
That's right. And don't forget the commerce side, because after that, you can charge a one-time fee or you can even sell a subscription.
Yeah. So turn your creativity into income with Squarespace courses. And right now, go to squarespace.com/stuff for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code STUFF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace. And now a word from the show's sponsors at Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture, shall we? You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that might not be for you.
That's right, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle.
How? Good question. Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic.
But you don't have to be, because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. So visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Hey friends, as every parent knows, kids seem to be everywhere all at once, and it's really tough for even the most watchful moms and dads to protect their little ones from every single thing.
Yeah, Duracell understands this, and that's why they're deeply committed to lithium coin battery safety. Lithium coin batteries power a bunch of important things around people's homes, including things young children may have access to. So Duracell not only educates parents, caregivers, and medical professionals about the importance of lithium coin battery safety, they also make the only lithium coin batteries with a non-toxic bitter coating to help discourage children from swallowing them.
Even Duracell's packaging is child secure and designed to avoid accidental opening. Because they believe their product should provide more than just power. They should also provide peace of mind. You can learn more at Duracell.com/power safely. Available on 2032, 2025, and 2016 sizes. All right. I teased the big eight. We're talking about the big eight areas, societies that dominated the Bronze Age. And they are not, this is not in order of influence or preference.
Even it's alphabetical.
It's not any, this is just randomly assimilated.
Okay.
Or assembled. Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
Not bad, actually. And as we'll see, the Egyptians, they didn't completely go away. They got punched in the face during the Bronze Age collapse, but they stuck around.
Yeah.
Egyptians, Hittites, Canaanites, Cypriots, Minoans, Mycenaeans, Assyrians, and rounding out the top eight, everyone's favorite, the Babylonians.
And this is like not all of these groups were dominant at one time, at the same time.
Yeah.
Some were dominant at one time or another, like the Minoans were the civilization that predated the Mycenaeans, right?
Mm-hmm.
So by quite several hundred years, if not longer, but each one dominated. They both controlled Crete while they were in charge. And if you look at these groups too, a lot of them are, I mean, I guess you'd call them famous, like the Babylonians, pretty famous. The Minoans, famous. The Egyptians, super duper famous.
Yeah, way famous.
And these were the groups that created the beginning of history. Like this was the time when the pyramids at Giza were built, or when the Epic of Gilgamesh was written and the Code of Hammurabi was encoded.
Yeah.
This is when pharaohs like Tutankhamun and Ramses II ruled. Like this was big deal, capital H history that was being produced at this time. And it seems to have all kind of started with the Sumerians. They seem to be the ones who like kicked the whole thing off.
Yeah. And we should mention, too, that all of those groups that we named had subgroups, a lot of ites.
Mm-hmm.
Hittites.
You want to tell them some ites?
Hivites, Amorites, Girgashites.
That's my favorite.
And these were all subgroups, and they even had subgroups, you know, under these umbrella terms like Canaanites. But Sumerians, like you said, came first. They said, hey, you like irrigation? What do you think about this canal?
Right.
What do you think about this ziggurat? What do you think about writing things down?
Yeah.
And now we can keep track of inventories and things like that and logbooks and money. Or like you mentioned, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Great read.
It's known as
the first work of literature.
Mm-hmm.
But what you also had because of this invention of writing was other cultures writing. And in a way that sort of helps corroborate what's going on. When you have different cultures writing about things that track or check one another, then you sort of get a better picture of what's happening.
Well, plus also when you have these diverse cultures that have different systems of writing and language, when they communicate with one another, they're often writing in two different languages.
Right.
So later historians, once you crack one language, you can use that to crack, like let's say you cracked hieroglyphics. You can use hieroglyphics to now crack Linear B, which was, I think, out of Crete, if I'm not mistaken. And if you crack Linear B, well, wait a minute. They used Linear B to write this cuneiform or cuneiform. So we can crack that now, too. So, like, almost all tablets written during this time were in multiple languages. So each one's like a Rosetta Stone.
Yeah.
It's really neat.
That is super cool. So everything's going great. People are trading. People are thriving. People are farming like never before. And all these advances are happening, and then boom, almost for the most part, everything stopped. Most of that development and almost all of those major civilizations kind of just went away. And like we said, the Iron Age came along. Looking now, my friend, I think this would have been the best place for a break.
Sure.
But I screwed that up. So we'll just dive right into what might have happened. The date of the collapse is generally given as 1167 BCE, but mm-hmm. it's obviously not the kind of thing that happens overnight. I think they generally now agree that it happened over the course of, what, 30 or 40 years?
Yeah, I think from about 1200 to 1150, which, I mean, if you're
pretty
living
quick.
Through that, it's 50 years at the time.
It's a lifetime.
Probably a lifetime.
Yeah.
But looking back historically, it's like the blink of an eye.
Yeah, and in a blink of an eye, things like when we talk about collapse, it was a pretty stark collapse. Like there's evidence of lots of disturbance, lots of upset in that region. And we'll get into everything that happened. I mean, we talked about the warring. People really started warring. And when certain civilizations might have fallen out of power, that created a vacuum there where a new civilization would come in.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these civilizations kind of going away, I believe it was like Sparta and Athens were the next to come along to really kind of kick off the next golden age, right?
Yeah, several hundred years later. And in between, there was what you would call a dark age, the Iron Age, which iron is preferable to bronze in some ways in that it can be harder, I believe,
yeah.
But bronze doesn't rust. So people typically look at the Iron Age, the transition from the Bronze Age into the Iron Age as a step backward, a dark age. And it came from this collapse, what's called the Late Bronze Age collapse, where, you know, you said that they really started warring and cities were sacked and burned. Cities have been like sacked before and burned before, but they were rebuilt during this mm-hmm. age of prosperity. This time after the Late Bronze Age collapse from 1200 to 1150, they weren't rebuilt. They were left in ruins and rubble because the civilizations that would have rebuilt them were gone. Their languages were gone. Their writing was gone. In very short time, people couldn't decipher things that had been written 50 or 100 years before.
Yeah.
It was just one civilization after another fell like dominoes all around the Mediterranean and this part of the world that gave the world essentially civilization for the very first time fell into this dark age. And it was such a stark, massive, all-encompassing collapse of the first attempt at civilization that it just piqued historians and archaeologists' curiosity from the first time they detected it. And they've been seeking to explain exactly what happened ever since.
Yeah, and we'll go over some of the causes, but after the cause, and there's a lot of debate over what those were, we have a civilization or a group of civilizations that we've talked about being very interconnected and dependent on one another.
Mm-hmm.
So you said they fell like dominoes. That's going to happen if you have a lot of civilizations trading with one another, depending on one another,
mm-hmm.
sharing resources with one another. When one goes down, then it becomes unstable for all of them. And, you know, if a civilization collapses, those people, it's not like everyone literally is destroyed. Like those people are going to go to the next closest place probably.
Mm-hmm.
And that overstresses them. And then it's just, like you said, it's just one after the other. This domino effect happens. And it just kind of happened one after the other over this very short time period.
Yeah, because remember, this is the first time when people followed a centralized government. And this is where you got your food, right?
Yeah.
So when that centralized government collapsed, you no longer had access to food. And you're like, I'm a mathematician. I have no idea how to grow grain. I'm going to starve to death if somebody doesn't do something.
You told me to do math.
Of course you're going to run to the next civilization that still has a central government with grain that they could possibly have. But that puts a strain on the grain and people start to fight when there's a strain on the grain. That's just how it goes, right?
That's a t-shirt waiting to happen.
So for one of the first people or one of the first theories that came along was posed by an Egyptologist, a French Egyptologist who coined the term the Sea People.
I like that.
The Sea People have long been, it sound ominous in this sense, don't they?
Yeah, when you capitalize the sea people,
yeah, yeah,
they're probably not bringing fruit baskets, you know?
No, unfortunately not. They were bringing death and destruction and mayhem, and in much the same way that we today think of like the Vikings would have to the UK and Western Europe. This is a very similar thing where a bunch of raiding pirates made land and just sacked all these civilizations. And so they're almost hypothetical, that we have a pretty good idea that they did exist in some form or another. They're written about in Egyptian stela. I can't remember how to say that. But inscriptions, let's just say. And they show up in art, too. So we know that they happen, but we don't know who these people are and what extent they sacked the major great city-states. And if they managed to topple all these civilizations, then holy cow, they were amazing. But a lot of people are like, I'm not sure they actually were the trigger. They might have been a symptom.
Yeah, and we don't, like you said, we don't even know for sure who they are. I believe Egyptians did identify some groups of them at the time as like the Oshawasha or the Luka or the Sheklesh. But that means nothing to us these days because their contemporary names were lost to history.
Right.
So what we call a lot of civilizations today were named by people who discovered their ruins years later, and that wasn't what they called themselves.
Right.
For instance, Minoans were named after the Greek king Minos by an archaeologist named Arthur Evans, Sir Arthur Evans. Mm-hmm. In some cases, we do know what they called themselves. In other cases, we don't. I think the Sumerians, we know, called themselves Ungsang Giga, which is black-headed people, but they were named Sumerians by Akkadians who followed after them.
Right.
So we have trouble with identifying people because the names were lost. We have trouble identifying people like the sea people because there's a very murky picture of who was where and when they were there.
Right.
So there's a lot of different stories where you think like one group of people maybe came in and overpowered another and drove them into oblivion, where it's like, no, now we believe that they were there sort of all along and they just filled that power vacuum, or maybe those actually were those people.
Right, right. Like for a good example is the Canaanites. For a very long time, the Philistines were blamed, and I mean a really long time, the Philistines were blamed for toppling the Canaanite Empire. But more recent scholarship says, actually, I think the Canaanites became the Philistines after the collapse. They kind of broke up as a group and then reformed. Like,
Trying to think of a band.
The only one I can think of is my high school band who broke up and reformed without me.
Without.
So let's just say that. That was like my high school band.
Oh, that story just breaks my heart every time I hear it.
Breaks my heart, too. But anyway, that's what they think happened. So a lot of the scholarship that we relied on for centuries, like the Canaanites were toppled by the Philistines, was incorrect. And we have to figure it out by deducing, well, wait a minute, this group was here at this time and this group was here at that time. The contemporary reports don't actually help us that much, because we might be totally familiar with the Sheklesh,
right?
But we call them the Mycenaeans.
Right, right.
But is it the Mycenaeans? Well, let's go and look. The Mycenaeans were toppled by the sea people, so probably not the Mycenaeans. So you have to use this historical deduction to try to figure out who these people were. But the upshot of it is that now today, and yes, I said upshot, by God, I'll say it again. The upshot of it is that today,
people drunk,
we think the sea people were basically like pirates of the days of yore, or more recent days of yore. They weren't from one particular country. They were a loose confederation of people.
Exactly. Which, I buy that. That makes sense.
Yeah. It makes a lot more sense than some group we are totally unfamiliar with or know by a different name, but haven't detected went and like just completely toppled every single culture and civilization in the Mediterranean at the time.
Yeah, I agree. Another thing that makes sense, and I'll go ahead and spoil it and say I think all these make sense. Mm-hmm. So I've subscribed to the, it was probably a little bit of everything, but overextension is a big one. If you are, this was their first foray into this kind of mass agriculturalism, and massive government and these big, big groups of people. And they, you know, it was just, it was their first try, humanity's first try at this stuff. So obviously it's going to not go perfectly. And if you're managing that many people, like any government has a limit on how many people, even today, that they can probably manage successfully. Any business does, any friend group does. So the fact that they just overextended themselves is probably a pretty good factor.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. So that's another theory just by itself, overextension. And once those governments are like, oh, God, I can't support everybody, there's like maybe a revolt or at the very least political instability and yada, yada, yada. Right.
And then dominoes.
One of the problems with that theory, though, is that we have letters from one group to another, from like the Hittite empress to the like Ramses II in Egypt saying like, hey, help. Which really shows the diplomacy and the interdependence. But it, they would say things like, hey, help, we're running out of grain. I need some food. Can you please send my people some grain? So that makes it seem like it wasn't just overextension, although it could have been overextension that led to it now that I kind of sussed it out.
Oh, well, look at that.
Yeah, we might just go edit that whole part out because it turned out to be totally unnecessary.
Well, two natural sort of disasters came together. That are obviously going to have a deleterious effect on civilizations.
Very nice.
Drought and earthquakes. We do know that there's a lot of evidence that there was a drought, a seemingly really long one. I think they've have actual proof of fossilized pollen from the bottom of the Sea of Galilee that said there was at least a 150-year drought.
Right.
And then other people say, no, it was probably more like 300 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's going to cause destabilization like nobody's business if your whole, like, sort of new societies are built on mass agriculture. People are going to start fighting. They're going to start warring with one another. I do think it's interesting that along with this theory, they say that the sea people might have been climate refugees from another part of the world. Very interesting. And, you know, back to what we said, like the great thing about this mass farming is all of a sudden it freed up people to do other things with the division of labor. But then when that was stressed, they had to pull people. Like you said, I was told I could do math. Not that there would be no math, quite the opposite. And they were pulled back from those jobs. So all of a sudden you had an end to other advances because you had to go. You were trying to save your society.
Yeah, and that the 2013 study, the one that determined the drought was 150 years long, also said that the end of the drought seems to coincide with the end of that dark age period and the rebuilding again of civilization. The earthquake thing makes a lot of sense, too. You remember, of course, the horrific earthquakes that Turkey suffered in February.
Yeah.
There was a 7.5 followed 9 hours later by a 7.8. And that is just mind-boggling. It killed 46,000 people. The thing is, that area, this area of the Mediterranean and then the Aegean as well, there's no less than four major plates that come together in this area, the Arabian, the African, the Anatolian, and the Eurasian plates all kind of converge around here. And so it's known for its earthquakes and also quake storms, which is what Turkey suffered recently. It's like earthquake after earthquake after earthquake, and a lot of them are really, really big. This area is kind of plagued with it and has been for a very long time. And there's plenty of evidence of earthquake damage, lots of poor souls being found trapped under their houses and foundations like just completely disrupted and walls at weird angles. So that definitely happened around this time. But then there's also other cities that were destroyed where you find like arrowheads embedded into the walls and like people with their heads cut off and stuff like that, where it's like an earthquake didn't do that. Some other group of people who attacked the city did that. So this kind of leads us to the one you subscribe to, which is everything, everywhere, all at once theory. Which is that there was basically a multiplier effect where one disaster happened that triggered other disasters and it just made those disasters worse and worse and worse. And that there was just a cascade of system failures that created this massive collapse.
Yeah. And again, going back to what I was saying earlier, it's like this was the first try at this kind of thing. And we'll get to maybe after the break, we'll talk about lessons we've learned, but you know, on a first attempt at this, this is a long time ago. There wasn't anything they could lean on in any of their histories to try and right the ship. So it just sort of went the way it went, you know, there was kind of almost no stopping it, I think.
So I'll give you another anecdote of mine that kind of exemplifies this. When Yumi and I moved into our first place that we ever bought together, I was installing something or other in the hot water pipe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The little condo, little tiny place.
Yep.
And I broke the hot water pipe at the water supply under the sink behind the valve. So there was no way to turn it off. And my response to that was to get up and literally run in a circle going, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. And Yumi had to run in and figure out what was going on and then run out and find the water main and turn it off.
Right.
That's what I imagine, like, some of these rulers did, like, after the first disaster or two. Because they had no... They had no frame of reference. I had no idea what to do right then. I didn't think like water main. They didn't even know there was a water main at the time. So
they had no Yumi. Kind of,
no, exactly. That's kind of the response I imagine them doing.
That's pretty funny.
And then there's one other one, Chuck. So you know how the Bronze Age led to the Iron Age?
Yeah.
And the division between the two is basically right there. After the late Bronze Age collapse, you've got the Iron Age almost immediately after it. And there is a... an idea that in Bronze Age Ireland, which suffered its own collapse later on, that it was the availability of iron that led to the collapse of the Bronze Age, because anybody could go find and work iron into something. You didn't need to have tin from over here and copper over here, massive trade networks and people at the top commanding everybody else. You could go out and find it yourself.
Yeah.
And this theory that in Ireland, at least, and it's possible it applies to the Mediterranean too, that it democratized it so much that it led to political instability, and hence that same destabilization where one civilization was toppled that led to another and another and another.
Boy, this is the side of history I love more than any other, I think, which are these just sort of things like this is how the earth was. Mm-hmm. And because you could find something here, it led to this, or you couldn't find something there, it led to this.
Right.
Just really fascinating to me.
Yeah, and also they think that the reason why we're able to find metals relatively close to the Earth's surface, enough so that we can mine them, and therefore have basically all technology, is because a small planetoid crashed into Earth, and that's where they think the moon came from, and that when it smashed into Earth, it pushed a lot of that molten metal to the surface where it cooled and formed and settled, allowing us to come billions of years later and dig it up and create civilization from it.
It really, like, just makes you think it's all just a crapshoot and we have no control over anything.
Sure. That or we're living in a really amazing simulation.
Yeah, that's right.
They're both right. They both could be right.
Is it blue pill or red pill? I can never remember.
Why not take both?
Yeah. All right, man. I'm hip to that. My, I don't know if I should tell the story.
If it's pill-based, maybe not.
Probably not. All right. So we'll take that break and we'll come back and talk, like I mentioned earlier, a little bit about the lessons we hopefully have learned from the late Bronze Age collapse.
So, Chuck, we were talking about lessons for today that you can take from the late Bronze Age collapse. And the most obvious one is don't globalize. It's a bad move. When you become super interconnected and interdependent on one another, a problem or a failure in one part of the system leads to just failures throughout the system because everyone's so dependent on one another. And if you kind of peel back the curtain a little bit or scratch that lotto ticket covering off, you see that most people who are saying that are probably nativist or anti-globalist to begin with. And that's
probably
what I was talking about before, where like you can see us reflected back when we're looking and interpreting what happened back then or the lessons from it. It really kind of reflects on what our thoughts and attitudes are today.
Yeah. And this isn't, you know, a big pro-globalist rant or anything, but we do have to kind of look around it. A pretty great recent example of a worldwide test put on all of our civilizations, which is the COVID pandemic that happened.
Right.
You know, this happened all over the world. Everyone was punched in the face. All, you know, societies were punched in the face. And there was no collapse. I mean, everyone got bruised up pretty bad. And I think the whole world suffered economically, as we're still seeing the fallout from that stuff today all over the world.
Right.
But no one collapsed. It's not like, you know, the UK is now, you know, just a warring society and everyone's like, you can't go there anymore because they collapsed because of COVID.
Right.
It was a really big test of our globalized world. And there are some very smart people who say, like, listen, you can't point to the Bronze Age collapse and say, like, that could happen again in modern times, because there's this one economist that you found, Zachary Yost, who is basically like, listen, we're way more wealthy than we were back then. Mm-hmm. We have capital goods like we never had before. And there's a big cushion that affords us mistakes these days, that they didn't have those mistakes. That's why, like I said, it was their first foray into this kind of thing. So they had a very narrow edge they were walking to begin with.
Right.
So they couldn't afford mistakes. We can afford mistakes these days and still be able to take a punch in the face and get back up and continue.
He also pointed out that, yeah, they had a division of labor, but our division of labor is global, and that, you know, we have a lot of redundancy in our systems too. So, yeah, he's saying, yes, you can make comparisons, but it's definitely not apples to apples because of how far we've come. And from the lessons that we learned from the times where civilization has collapsed and rebuilt and collapsed and rebuilt. The other way to look at it, there's a guy named Eric Klein, who's a professor of ancient Near East studies, who also wrote a book called 1167, The Year Civilization Collapsed. So he's a bit of an authority on this. His whole thing is, actually, no, we're probably more susceptible to collapse than the Bronze mm-hmm. Age was, because we're even more interconnected than we were before. And there's a systems dynamics term, I believe, called hypercoherence, where the system is so homogenous, all the different parts are so homogenous, that when one part, and also interconnected, that when one part breaks down, it just spreads really quickly and the whole system breaks down. And you can really kind of look around at the complexity of our world today. Like, just like, look at international banking. Mm-hmm. That's just one system in the larger, complex, globalized system. So when you take these complex systems and put them together with other systems like trade, stock markets, healthcare, and then realize that all those systems make up a truly global, ultimately complex system, then you're like, actually, yeah, we're possibly even more susceptible to breaking down than the Bronze Age was.
Yeah, which is scary to think about. But like, as far as anti-globalists saying, like, we need to undo this, mm-hmm. that ship has sailed, don't you think? I mean, things are so interconnected and we have such a globalist world that it's, you can't unwind that clock, I don't think,
no,
at this point.
And if you could, you can, but it would be a really rough, unpopular transition. But then what? You're the odd man out and the rest of the world is working together. And what happens if you need help from the rest of the world? How easy is it for you to get that help? There's downsides to both globalism and nativism, right? Neither one is just shown to be the right way to go. And also, this is a really good point too, Chuck. We don't know that collapse is inevitable from complexity. Mm-hmm. We also don't know that it's you can reach a point of complexity where it's so complex that it actually becomes more stable. We haven't figured this stuff out yet, but either one's not inevitable, collapse or success. So the best thing we can do is just invest in ways to be resilient.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can even narrow that down to like secessionists these mm-hmm. days, mm-hmm. where it's like, good luck with that, man. Right. Have you really thought this through? Yeah. Or do you just like the idea of giving the finger to the rest of the country?
Yeah. For sure. I mean, that's a great question. I'd love to hear it answered, too.
Yeah, in like a really thought out way. Like, here's how that would work exactly.
Right. Everybody's going to wear the same kind of flannel shirt. It's going to be awesome.
Seattle?
I was thinking more Kansas, the legit flannel shirts. So what else? There's another lesson too, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think a more hopeful lesson is that, like you kind of touched on earlier at the beginning, when you have diverse groups of people interacting, like what usually has followed is affluence and peace. And that's what happened here for a long time as well.
Right. Even more than just the Late Bronze Age, after that collapse, I think the Phoenicians really kind of rose to power. And they were a seafaring people. And mm-hmm. one of the first things they did was start peddling their purple dyes that they were famous for around the Mediterranean. And they ended up establishing new trade networks with other groups that had survived the collapse and started to rise to power. And so the whole thing began again.
It's so funny to think about. It's like everyone's like, what is that? And they're like, it's purple.
Right.
People are going to go wild for this stuff, and new civilizations will be built because people are so wild about this color.
Yeah. And it's true. I mean, that was a huge driver of it. Purple dye.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
It is. But the upshot is, sorry, everybody.
Oh, boy.
That when we, it almost seems like it's just going to happen, whether we like it or not. The more we kind of grow as a people and grow technologically and in intelligence, we seek out other people to interact with and trade with and become more prosperous with. And if we do it peacefully, then prosperity follows. That seems to be a huge part of not just the Bronze Age, but also what emerged from the Dark Age that followed after the Late Bronze Age collapse.
Yeah.
It's like a big cycle. But if it is a big cycle, then it makes you nervous because then that means we're due for a collapse at some point.
Yeah.
Unless we've become so resilient and redundant in our system that we are going to avoid a collapse from now on. I don't think that's right. I don't think we've reached that yet, but I think it's possible to reach that.
Did you touch on any of this in The End of the World with Josh Clark?
I don't think so. No, not really.
All right.
Thank you for that plug, though.
Sure. You know, I listened to about half of those. It was too smart for me.
BS.
It really was.
It's not. I was like, you're man, like, this I can't is great. Listen to this guy's voice.
No, it's not that. Of course not.
What about, there's one more, Chuck, that we have to touch on. It's climate change. It's a big deal. It's a big enough deal that it's possible it drove the collapse of our first attempts at civilization. So there's not necessarily a lesson of what to do in there, but at the very least, it's like a, hey, pay attention to what's going on.
Yeah. And we've seen, you know, when natural disasters happen, large groups of people moving to another place en masse. I mean, those are sort of more micro examples of the bigger picture that happened back then, but that's what happens.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
And sometimes people stay.
Yeah. Some people make it, the people who like it really hot and wet.
Yeah, not me.
No. You like it cold, don't you? Like, genuinely.
I love the cold weather, but I don't like, you know, six-month winters. It's not like I'm sure. have any desire to move to Minnesota
no.
and endure that stuff. But I do love cold weather. It suits me.
That's great. You got anything else?
I got nothing else.
Well, since Chuck was talking about how cold weather suits him, that triggers the collapse of this episode into the dark age of a listener mail.
All right, I'm going to call this, oh boy, crossword puzzle follow-up.
This is a very dark age.
This is the episode where people don't like us even having the most minor of disagreements.
I know.
I mean, I had people writing in, they were like, you need to get rid of Chuck. That smug SOB.
It's crazy.
I was like, geez, I hope I'm not on that thin of ice.
No, you're not, of course years. Not. Some people just have opinions that are outlandish.
So here's a couple of things here from two people. Hey guys, love the show. I was excited to hear you talk about crosswords. Josh talked about how all crosswords are symmetrical. And Chuck said today's was not. I thought it was cool because I distinctly remembered the New York Times February 16th, 2023 was not symmetrical.
What?
After Chuck and Josh took a second look, Chuck saw he was mistaken. And the crossword did have symmetry, so the episode was probably recorded on some other day. All of this to say, asymmetric crosswords are very rarely published, but if they are, they likely have some trick or rebus in order to solve it. We didn't talk about rebuses in the show.
No, but you wanted to, right? Did you want to mention that, what that is?
Yeah, a rebus is something I didn't know about when I started out, which is put you at a very distinct disadvantage.
Yeah.
Because it's when you include multiple letters in a single square. And John Hodgman told me about it, and I was like, well, how are you supposed to know? He said, well, once you know it's a thing, you might be on the lookout if you're like, for sure you know a clue, but it's not fitting.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, how do you even do that on a phone? And there's a little rebus button.
Oh, yeah,
what
is it?
I never knew. Well, it's on like the second keyboard, like the one you go to for numbers mm-hmm. and symbols and things.
Yeah, what does it look like?
It says Rebus.
Oh, really? I've never noticed that before.
Well, it's only when you're doing the crossword. I don't think it just pops up.
I gotcha.
So anyway, that was from Alec, and then this is from David, and we got a bunch of other people that explained why I was getting tripped up, because what you were describing was radial symmetry.
Okay, yeah, right.
Which is rotational symmetry. If you rotate an empty crossword 180 degrees and it looks the same, I was looking at, I think there are four types of symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at whatever the one is called. Maybe it is called mirror symmetry. I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's the exact same on the left and right. And that's why I was like, no, it's not. I'm looking at it. So you were describing radial symmetry. And David from Snowy Montreal wrote that along with a bunch of other people.
Yeah.
And that helped me feel better that I wasn't crazy. And now I know there are four types of symmetry.
Yeah, the one that includes all four types is very pleasing. That's why they call it supersymmetry.
Oh, really?
No, I just...
Oh, okay. Jeez.
I think supersymmetry has to do with string theory, and I'm not sure. We should do an episode on string theory once. Would you be willing to give it a shot with me?
Right after I retire, you can do that one.
All right. Deal. Well, thanks a lot to Smart Alec and Smart David for writing in to let us know what the deal was and why we were miscommunicating. And everybody, calm down. Chuck and I love each other. Don't worry about that. And we both love Jerry. So calm down.
Agree.
If you want to send us a listener mail, you can send it via email to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. But you know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line, thanks to Visible. It's true. So switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Childproofing people's homes is hard, but Duracell is making it just a bit simpler. Not only are they committed to educating parents, caregivers, and medical professionals about the importance of battery safety, they make the only lithium coin batteries with a non-toxic bitter coating to help discourage children from swallowing them. Duracell even features child-secure packaging designed to avoid accidental opening. Learn more at Duracell.com/power safely. Available on 2032, 2025, and 2016 sizes.